support staff and have three of my favorite people in the Presbyterian Church. Cindy Wilson and Brian, and I'm not making that up. That's really true. And I think of some churches where I have one of my favorite people. A couple churches where I actually have two. I can't think of another church where I have three. On Sunday, I think one of the great poetic teachers and theologians of her generation and my generation, Austin, the great poet. Today, you ordained Brian Russo to the Presbyterian ministry. Later in the service, we will lay hands on him and extend to him the traditional greeting, "Welcome to this ministry." This ministry that is bigger than you are, that existed long before you were here, and will continue to unfold in new ways long after you have departed. This ministry that belongs to us all. For each one of us has been baptized into this ministry in the service of this gospel and in the service of our gracious and wondrous God. Today, however, what we mean by ministry, by gospel, even what we mean by Christianity has become increasingly unclear. So divided is the American Christian world today that when we say to young people, "Welcome to this ministry," they might well respond, "Into which ministry do you mean? Into which gospel? In the name of which God?" Have time this morning to look at all the statistics of where young people are in relationship to American religion, but it's not happening. So on this day of ordination, two passages, one from Luke and the other from the book of Acts, offer us some clarity concerning this question. So I'm going to spend more time on the first passage and just touch briefly on this second. The first passage is set in Nazareth at the synagogue, and it deals with God's choosing of Jesus in Luke. The second passage in Acts deals with God's choosing of the Apostle Paul. The first, in which we hear Jesus saying, "I have been chosen to preach the good news to the poor," offers a clarifying statement of the central content of Jesus' ministry. In fact, a few chapters later, when John the Baptist asks whether Jesus is genuinely the Messiah, Jesus doubles down on this Nazareth sermon, saying, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised. The poor have good news brought to them, and blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." So this first passage gives us sort of a criterion for which ministry, which gospel, which God we're talking about. The second passage regarding the choosing of Paul reminds us that interpreting this gospel presents an ongoing task. one which may work itself out, in fact, I would argue, most often works itself out in strange and unexpected ways. In this case, the strange and unexpected result of outreach to the Gentiles of all people, and the strange persecutor of the church, Paul of Tarsus, selected for the assignment. So, what is it these two passages teach us concerning authentic ministry in the service of an authentic gospel? The first passage, set in Nazareth, in it Jesus proclaims he has been anointed, ordained by God's own hand to proclaim the gospel, and he uses quotations from Isaiah to offer us a radical vision of what that gospel is. I don't use the word radical loosely. It means literally going to the root. And Jesus' gospel goes to the root of what it means to love God, love neighbor, and live into an authentic Christian way of life. And Jesus' gospel is radical in a number of ways. Jesus' gospel is radical in its content and consistency. Its content consistently is that of justice, challenging the reigning powers, and calling into question many aspects of the current state of affairs. We know we're confronted with the authentic gospel of Jesus when good news is proclaimed to the poor, when release comes to those in bondage, whatever sort of bondage that may be, when new sight is given to the blind, whether their blindness be literal or metaphorical, when freedom comes from structures that are dehumanizing, and when we see the sort of economic freedom for people, and the sort of ecological freedom for the land that is implicit in the notion of the year of Jubilee. Second, Jesus' gospel is radical not only in its consistency concerning justice, but secondly in terms of its urgency. Our reading of Luke today deliberately ended with verse 21. Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Jesus not only affirms Isaiah's vision of deliverance to the captives, but he gives it a twist. This deliverance is no longer just a future expectation of high-in-the-sky hope. Rather, it is already becoming a present reality before their very eyes. The kingdom is unfolding in the midst of them in real time. The way Martin Luther King used to talk about it, and to capture this gospel urgency, he would speak of the fierce urgency of now. And Jesus is saying, become my followers, and you will begin to see the kingdom now. Third, Jesus' gospel is radical not only in its consistency and its urgency, in its sense of agency. Jesus understands God to be the primary agent of social and political change. But here's what's so easy to miss. God's agency is exercised through our agency and our obedience. This happens first and foremost through the obedience of Jesus himself. What we do are called to become secondary agents of God's primary agency. Turn the other cheek, just to take sort of a random example of all Jesus' teachings. Turn the other one, make decisions. This is at the center of the thing, right? Love your neighbor, love your enemy. Turn the other cheek isn't just about sitting there waiting for God to rescue. Jesus' ministry was radical in its scope. What do I mean by that? Jesus ate meals with outcasts. He hung around with the poor. He had women as disciples. And he treated women in remarkably empowering ways for that day and time. And most notably of all, and most difficult to put out, he taught us that love of neighbor extends even to love of our enemies. Anytime you're dealing with Jesus, you're dealing with a part of a Jew who says, you think you understand Torah? Guess what? It goes way deeper than you think. It's not just love your neighbor. Your neighbor includes your enemy. Now, for his people, the Nazarene, as it turned out, this teaching of openness to enemies was a bridge too far. They turn against Jesus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all agree that the Nazarenes rejected Jesus. But in a portion of Luke, we didn't read today in the interest of time, Luke tells us why they turned against Jesus. Luke says, at first, the Nazarenes welcomed Jesus' message of deliverance to the poor, to the oppressed, and to the forgotten. Why? Because living as they did under Roman dominance, the Nazarenes thought of themselves as the poor, the oppressed, and the forgotten. And no wonder. It's not ever mentioned in the New Testament, but this is one of these areas where you get to know that's your plans to understand Jesus. When Jesus was a boy, the Romans had marched through the nearby city of Sepphoris, just 3.5 miles from Nazareth, and they literally destroyed it. Sort of like a 9/11 moment for them, carrying many back to Rome in chains to be slaves, pillaging the countryside, violating Jewish women, and crucifying many of the rebels. History says 2,000. I don't know how many actually was, but let's just say it was a lot. So make no mistake, this carnage made an indelible impression on the Nazarenes. And some who no doubt remembered that bloodshed wouldn't have been there in that synagogue listening to Jesus that morning. Good news for the oppressed, good news for the poor, deliverance from the captives. That's the message they had been waiting for. So at first, Luke says the Nazarenes were glad to hear their native son declare what sounded to them like a nationalistic message of victory for Israel. Something akin to, let's make Israel great again. But Jesus was not talking about renewing the armed revolution. Jesus was talking about something else, something far more difficult to hear. Jesus, again, the portion of Luke that follows when you read it, and I'm going to tell it to you so you kind of see what's happening here. He reminded the Nazarenes that his ministry, his gospel, his God, often works outside conventional limits, including the conventional limits of tribe. Jesus reminded them of an instance in Israel's past when the prophets Elijah and Elisha called upon the power of Israel's God, not to heal Jews, but to heal Gentiles. The very suggestion that God might show grace to Gentiles, these disgusting Romans who had enslaved women and children and butchered their friends, the very talk of showing favor to these foreigners so enraged the Nazarenes that Luke says they wanted to run Jesus off a cliff. Which brings us to our second passage concerning Ananias. And here we are. church. The one who possessed the power to arrest the Gentiles, possibly have him put to death. But amazingly, Ananias put aside his prejudices, his fear. He goes to Paul. He even calls him brother. He lays hands upon Paul and he commissions him to minister to these non-Jewish people, the very Gentiles, whom the Nazarenes so despised. Understandably, mind you. They couldn't hear the word of the gospel. Love your neighbor includes love your enemies. Oh, think how the recent history of this country for the past 17 years, to be specific, how might it be different if we could hear that message? We've been in the National Cathedral just 3 days after 9/11, when we heard a sermon. If that sermon had contained even the smidgen of this message, how might things have been different? This gospel, this ministry, often worked themselves out in surprising and sometimes even shocking ways. Even the times in which we're living is so shocking, to me at least. I firmly believe that the Lord God Almighty and the Spirit of God in Jesus Christ are at work. For Paul and Ananias, the new and unexpected aspect of the gospel back then was the inclusion of the Gentiles. At other times going forward, the unexpected directions of the gospel, the deeper regions of faithfulness to which the gospel has called us, has created radical change in the social order, such as the abolition of slavery, the fight for civil rights, racial reconciliation, the ordination of women, the full inclusion of gender-varied people. But today, some of us hear it calling us to recommit ourselves a responsible stewardship of the earth, which is the Lord's. Let me close with an example of this shift from religion as usual to religion that changes the world. I'm going to give you a real life story concerning another native son, this time one from Philadelphia, who lived before the Civil War. His name was John Peter Leslie, went by Peter, the name of Peter. Peter Leslie was trained, in fact, that Peter Leslie has his historical house in Philly, on prison today. Peter Leslie was trained as a geologist. But he also studied theology at, of all places, Princeton Seminary. Graduated in 1844, became an ordained Presbyterian minister. Eventually, he took a pastorate in a Reformed church, Congregationalist, in Milton, Massachusetts, where three things happened to him. First, he fell in love. He married a young woman, Susan, who was involved in the anti-slavery movement. And so soon, Peter became involved as well. Second, Peter and Susan met a fugitive slave named Mary Walker. Now, Mary Walker had escaped from her owner in North Carolina. And she escaped when she learned that the owner was going to sell her to a plantation in the Deep South. So she fled. In fact, she had been brought here to Philly, and she slipped away and escaped. Peter and Susan Leslie met Mary Walker, and they invited her to live with them as a free woman. Then in 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, and this required people in the North to return fugitive slaves to their owners in the South. By making a conscious Leslie knew they were engaging in a criminal act. But they did it anyway. In short, they went from being merely anti-slavery to becoming abolitionists. And not just abolitionists, sort of in principle, but their lives were on the line. Eventually, they helped Mary Walker buy her children out of slavery and reunite her with her family. That's an amazing story. There's a book about it if you want to read more. Meanwhile, a third thing happened to Peter Leslie. As he got more involved in the abolitionist movement, his theology became, guess what, increasingly radical. When the church leadership caught wind of this, they accused him of heresy. In particular, they accused him of no longer affirming a literal view of biblical inspiration. To make a very long story short, Peter Leslie was forced out of the Presbyterian ministry. He became a famous theology professor at the University of Pennsylvania. His ordination was revoked. But I ask you to consider which ministry was the authentic ministry to which Peter Leslie was called and ordained. Was it the ministry of upholding an abstract doctrinal purity? Or was it the ministry of bringing liberty to the captives, such as Mary Walker? The presbytery that rejected Peter Leslie back then surely could have learned a thing or two from that courageous, visionary leader who encountered the risen Christ in the city of Damascus so long ago. And I'm speaking, of course, not of Paul, but of Ananias. The ordination of Paul that day was equally the ordination and the calling of Ananias. Not all of us are called to suffer the way Paul was called to suffer. We had that second passage end. I don't know if you noticed it, but Brian was squirming. We had it end of the verse. I myself will show him how much he will suffer for my name's sake. Not all of us are called to suffer like Paul. You'd be glad to know, Brian. But all of us are called to this ministry, this gospel, this God of Ananias. Ananias, who lived and ministered in the power of that same one who was anointed to proclaim good news to the poor, and whose power has freed so many captives, including Mary Walker, including Peter Leslie, including Ananias and Paul, including you and me. It is into this life-changing, world-changing gospel that all of us have been baptized. It is into this ministry of liberation and healing that Brian Russo is being ordained today. It is to this gracious and powerful God that we give thanks, whose word is being fulfilled with fresh urgency and in ever surprising